Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, 10 years on, the town of Omagh remembers victims of the most devastating bomb blast in the Northern Irish conflict. And Held in Trust, a Jesuit church in Liverpool hosts an exhibition tracing the troubled history of Catholicism in England. This month of August, the people of Omagh in Northern Ireland have been marking a bitter anniversary. It's now 10 years since a car bomb ripped through a busy shopping street on the afternoon of August 15th, killing 29 people plus two unborn twins. The bomb was planted by a dissident Republican group, the Real IRA, aiming to disrupt the peace process that had been spelt out 4 months earlier in the so-called Good Friday Agreement. Yet a decade on from that massacre, those responsible for planting the bomb and masterminding the attack have not been identified, and many are still finding it hard to come to terms with this lack of justice for their loved ones.
Some are hoping that they will eventually get clarification on what precisely happened and who did it. Others, I think, are resigned to the fact that such a period of time has now passed that it may be difficult to achieve that. So feelings are mixed.
Bishop Seamus Hegarty heads the Diocese of Derry, which includes the town of Omagh. He talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane of his memories of that terrible day.
I recall very clearly I was there on site within a few hours of the explosion. Was there with the people in the hospital and with the relatives who were looking for their loved ones because, understandably, there was a great mayhem and a confusion because people did not know whether their missing relatives were alive or dead. And subsequently, my auxiliary bishop and myself, and indeed my predecessor, we spent the subsequent days conducting funerals of victims, and that was certainly one of the most tragic and distressing experiences I had pastorally. 10 years on, yes, much has happened. In the meantime, the families did adjust remarkably well. Clearly, they are still hurting. They still have very fond memories of their departed relatives, they clearly are marking this event 10 years on as a milestone in their grieving process.
I mean, the memories, even for yourself, for families, for everything, they must be still vivid, even though 10 years have passed.
Yes, they are. But the people of Omagh are a very good people, a people of faith. People who are very resilient, and even 10 years ago they did show remarkable composure. I saw them and celebrated Mass for them a week after the tragedy itself, and again after a month, and I could see significant progress being made in their capacity to deal with their tragedy. And they also demonstrated tremendous dignity, even though they were heartbroken and bereaved, particularly where children were involved. And it's very important to remember the unborn twins who were not mentioned maybe in the earlier dispatches sufficiently clearly. They never saw, the light of day at all. So it really was extremely traumatic. Not just for those who were immediately involved in it, but for the entire community. It was an incident and a tragedy which resonated not just through Northern Ireland, but through the whole island of Ireland as a whole, and indeed further afield. The real answer to solving the problem has yet to be found. There are many theories about what happened and who was responsible. That has never been fully clarified yet. It's an ongoing process. and there are people who are endeavouring to get to the bottom of what happened and what the motivation was.
As a pastor yourself, when you heard about it, when you first heard about it, I mean, how did you even prepare yourself for what you were about to see?
Well, I actually was about 80 miles away from Omagh when I heard it. I was in West Donegal, and I accidentally heard that there was a bomb in Omagh. So I decided, I have two parishes in Omagh, and I left immediately and made my way to Omagh. And I visited the hospital first, and it was the surgeons in the hospital and the hospital staff did absolutely superb work in keeping so many very badly injured victims alive. That's my memory of it. And then I moved into a leisure centre where there were over 1,000 people gathered together, traumatised because their loved ones were, as far as they were concerned, dead, at best missing, and if they were lucky, they were in a hospital. Because as the people who were not too badly injured, they were taken to other hospitals in Northern Ireland and indeed to the Republic as well. So there was such a mayhem that people were simply sent on helicopters and transported to other hospitals. Meantime, their relatives in Omagh, and particularly in the leisure centre on that night, did not know whether their relatives were alive or dead. And I remember at that very gathering at midnight, a number of clergy were there from all denominations, and then president of the Methodist Church and myself, we led the people in a prayer at midnight. But it was only in subsequent days then that the location of the survivors who were in the hospital were declared.
How important was fate then, and how important is it now to the people that went through it, to the people of Omagh?
That is very difficult to say. On the face of it, it appears as if they, you know, picked up the strands of life and had to go on because they had other children, other responsibilities. But only they can tell, you know, the residual effects of the trauma which it had on them. They will never obliterate it from their minds at all. They are living with it, coping with it very courageously and in faith.
You can rebuild a town after a terrible incident, a terrible attack, but the actual town itself, the soul of a town, how much has that been scarred and how much is the town been able to move on from all this?
Well, after a relatively short time after the tragedy, they began rebuilding the fabric of the town, in the sense that they restored buildings, and they got back to normality amazingly quickly. And all the while, there was a constant development and refurbishment, rebuilding, replacement of some of the buildings. So from the point of view of the actual restoring of the fabric of the town, it went quite a pace at that time. The other thing, the building up of the community and trying to get the community to get back to reasonable normality, that did take a long time, and that is an ongoing process. And as I said earlier, for some it has achieved a certain level of success. For others, they are still on the way. But as I said, the people of Omagh and the surrounding districts, and some people were there from the surrounding districts from other dioceses also, they are a very resilient people, and they are a people of faith, and that no doubt has sustained them in the past and will continue to sustain them in the time ahead.
And each of them is coping in their own way, some very private, some very public. all grieving and some searching for answers.
Father Kevin Mullen serves as parish priest not far from Omar, and he was also among the religious of all different denominations who arrived in the wake of the bombing to minister to the sick and dying.
I was part of a very big team, and the churches, and Omar was well supplied with clergy at the time. They worked together in various locations on the street, in the hospital and in other hospitals elsewhere, and visiting homes. So there was a huge togetherness of ministry. But I think each minister performed an individual space with an individual person and gave them the love that you would give to any person in dying circumstances. So it's a tapestry of care that only afterwards did you realise the vastness of what was happening. So it's an event that really entered into the being of everybody, and it's marked a stage in everybody's life journey. On August 98, I was doing this, and since that, I've been doing that. It's been one of those milestones that are in the calendar of everybody's life. And I hope it has been a milestone that has opened people up to the greater dimensions of life and death and eternity. And I think it unleashed what was there already, a great love of everybody. I noticed, and I've noticed since that, a great openness to one another, a great gentleness, a great spirit of cooperation between the churches, and a welcome in places that maybe you might have gone before, where people recognized you as someone who had helped their injured and the people from their community. And there was a lovely sense of being respected. And I do think that the opinion was that the churches in general ministered in a very intense and loving way and brought the gospel into very real context throughout that day and the years following.
On the day, for you as a priest working on that day, how much did that teach you and how much has it taught you in your work now?
I suppose I had, at that stage, a certain number of years of priesthood behind me, and Northern Ireland had a long history of tragedy behind it as well. And through different pastoral postings, I had encountered the effects of bombs and bullets. But it happened at a time when we believed that all that was behind us and that peace had broken out. It just brought me up again against the stupidity of the human mind and heart, that at times it just cannot accept that there is a better way and fall back on old ways. And that battle hasn't yet been won. I suppose until the end of time it won't be won, because we're forever forgetting. The Lord is always saying, you have eyes that don't see and ears that never hear and never listen. We are all the time struggling, even in our own hearts, with falling back on old ways. So there was that battle going on there, and as I say, we're still fighting it.
I suppose you can never be prepared for something like that, though, can you?
Well, I don't think anybody was. I mean, it was the greatest, in terms of single atrocity death, the greatest tragedy of the Northern conflict. I remember just on the day, everywhere I looked in the street, there were bodies. Now, thankfully, a friend of mine had covered the bodies with drapes taken from the dry cleaners, and out of respect, and I suppose out of just fear myself of seeing what I was afraid to see, I didn't pull back any of the drapes. I prayed over the covered bodies. Only one was at that stage still not covered. But I've heard from friends since that they were there earlier than I was, and they were picking up dying, and they were picking up limbs that had been amputated. They were comforting little ones who were crying for their mommy. The memory is just devastating.
10 years on, I'm sure there's still anger that those responsible haven't been brought to justice for this terrible crime. Is that still a feeling that abounds in Omar?
Yes and no. There are obviously questions that have not been answered and may never be answered. Is there proof that somebody did something? Are there other sinister elements of collaboration between God knows who, were things allowed to happen. There's also the school of opinion that even if we do find out, it won't change our suffering or our dignity. One victim who suffered severely and has miraculously survived said, I don't really want to know because it would only make me too angry. And we also have to grapple with, and this is the church's ministry again, with the gospel of loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you and forgiving. So those tensions are still there in the community.
And my thanks there to Father Kevin Mullen talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. And earlier you heard Bishop Seamus Hegarty of the Diocese of Derry. A precious relic believed to be from Jesus' crown of thorns, a lock of hair and a tartan kilt once owned by Bonnie Prince Charlie, and a plain felt hat that belonged to a young lawyer, later to become St. Thomas More. Plus an impressive collection of ancient missals and manuscripts, vestments and other artefacts that were hidden away during the darkest days of religious persecution in England. All of these are now on display at an exhibition entitled Held in Trust at a Jesuit-run church in Liverpool, the northern city currently celebrating its role as the European capital of culture. St. Francis Xavier's is a beautiful Gothic revival church founded by 9 former students from a nearby Jesuit school not long after the passing of the Catholic Emancipation Act that put an end to active persecution or discrimination. Located in one of the poorest parts of Liverpool, the church is now hosting this free exhibition which offers some rare insights into the religious history of those centuries, both in Britain and on other continents where Jesuit missionaries were carrying the gospel message.
A whole lot of snapshots of British history and British Catholic history are there in this exhibition.
The administrator at St. Francis Xavier and the brain behind this inspirational exhibition is Brother Ken Vance. I asked him how the idea first came about.
Yes, the idea came up about 4 years ago. Liverpool had just been awarded European Capital of Culture for 2008. And a group in the parish got together and thought, how can we celebrate this event? Now, our parish is situated in quite a poor area of Liverpool, so we weren't quite sure what to do. And then finally the idea came up that Stonyhurst College, which is about 50 miles away from SFX, St. Francis Xavier's, is connected. It's a Jesuit high school. St. Francis Xavier's parish started from Stonyhurst in the 1840s. And they had a whole series of beautiful treasures in their archives. And we thought, why don't we bring some over to Liverpool?
So that people can get to see these things. I mean, they're really quite a collection, aren't they, dating back centuries?
Oh, indeed. A lot of them were given to the Jesuits during penal times when the church was persecuted. And a lot of Catholics thought, oh, the Reformation will blow over and things will get back to normal. So let's just keep these and then bring them out of the cupboard after the dust settles. Of course, the dust hasn't settled. The Reformation carried on. And so we've still got all those bits and pieces that people gave us.
Tell us about some of the most impressive exhibits that will be on show then.
One of the main exhibits is Thomas More's hat, St. Thomas More. The hat itself he wore when he was a young lawyer, and he left it in the house of some friends on the continent. He visited them in Belgium, though it wasn't Belgium in those days, and he left it behind. And they kept it, and after he'd been martyred, they used to bring it out of the cupboard each year on the anniversary of his martyrdom. And then finally they sent it back to Britain, and it came into the possession of the Jesuits of Stonyhurst.
So that's one of the most interesting pieces. You've also got, I see, a book of homilies, for example, from Pope Gregory, dating back to 1170. I mean, some really ancient works here.
Oh, indeed, yes. There's quite a few beautifully illustrated manuscripts. We've got Cardinal Wolsey's prayer book. It was given to Cardinal Wolsey by the papal legate that came over to sort out Henry VIII's divorce proceedings. So that's got quite a bit of history in itself. And then several beautifully illuminated books of hours and there's a prayer book from Saint-Chapelle, and in one of the pages it's got almost an itinerary of the relics that were kept there. So you can spend ages going round these and marvelling at the wonderful illuminations and the gold, which still looks as if it was only put in there a day ago, you know.
I was going to say, I mean, these things date back centuries. Where have all these things been kept over the years?
Well, when the church was going through a sort of persecution period, the penal times, the Jesuits, the British Jesuits, started a college on the continent. It moved around a bit depending on the politics of the day. So it was in Liège, Saint-Omer, and Bruges for a while. And people sent their precious articles over there for safekeeping. Held in trust is the title, and that's what they gave us, to hold in trust for better times. So this stuff was trundled around, kept in these colleges and trundled around from place to place as they moved. And finally, at the end of the 18th century, when things got quieter and more pleasant for the Catholic population in Britain, they came back over to Britain and landed at Stonyhurst in Lancashire. And they brought all these things out of the various boxes they were carrying, and they were now on display there.
So these exhibits really, in a way, reflect, don't they, the incredibly troubled history of the church, not just in Liverpool, but in that part of the world particularly.
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah. And there's a beautiful chasuble made by Helen Winter. She embroidered it. In fact, she embroidered five for the Jesuits of her day. Now, three of her brothers were implicated in the gunpowder plot, and they all lost their lives because of that. And we had this little image of Helen in the next room while the plotters were plotting away, and there she was with her needle and cotton sewing away. But they are beautiful vestments. So a whole lot of snapshots of British history and British Catholic history are there in this exhibition.
Now, it's important, I imagine, that people from around the country come and have a look at these, and yet many of them won't know much about, apart from a few odd details, but most people won't know much about many of these stories of suffering and persecution, will they?
No, and we've got a beautifully illustrated catalogue, 200 pages long. The exhibition is divided into five different sections: pre-Reformation, Reformation, Recusant, and so on. And at the beginning of each of those sections, there's an essay by a British scholar on that period. So it gives them an introduction to that. And then each of the artefacts has two pages. On one side is a picture, and the other side a full explanation about what the artefact is and how it came into Jesuit hands.
You're talking a little bit about the past, the history of the church there in Liverpool, but even up until very quite recently, it was an incredibly troubled place to be a Catholic, wasn't it? I mean, it was almost as divided as Northern Ireland, for example, until not very long ago.
Well, more so in some cases. A few years ago, I met Gerry Adams, who was prominent in Northern Ireland, as you know, and I spoke to him about the problems we had in Liverpool when I was a child, the orange and the green. And I said, you know, we used to throw bricks at each other. And he said, well, they didn't do that in Ireland until the trouble started, which surprised me a little bit. He said there was a little bit of integration when he was younger. It was only in the 70s and 80s, when the communities divided it wider than they had been, that bigger trouble started. But St. Francis Xavier's Church is situated in one of the sort of epicentres of troubles in Liverpool. And every 12th of July, when the Orange Lodge march, and it still does march from time to time, when they pass the church, the choir would sing in English, Hail Glory St. Patrick, or Faith of Our Fathers, while the Orange Lodge marched outside banging their drum. It was quite a traumatic period for the school children in our local school. But thank God that's over now, and the local vicar, Henry Corbett, comes along regularly, and he's visited the exhibition a couple of times already, and we have quite a few joint services together over the year.
Do you see this exhibition in some way as something that is bringing back a lot of these problems from the past, or do you think in some way it can actually help on the ecumenical journey there?
I don't think it's bringing the problems back. It's recognising the fact that they have happened, but we've moved on. And now we can look at these and say, well, you know, have we learned from the past? So it's an educational idea that we have about the exhibition.
If I'm not mistaken, there are also some interesting exhibits from other faith traditions, from Islam, Hindu, Buddhist pieces. Where do these come into the picture?
From a variety of sources, Stonyhurst is a public school, and in Victorian times, a lot of the former pupils, boys in those days, it's co-ed now, but they went out with the British Empire, as it was, and sent stuff back. So we've got a whole variety of things, and we wanted to make that statement that it's not just Catholic history we're representing. There's a beautiful piece of the Quran from the 10th century, and also a Muslim marriage contract from Victorian times. It's a beautifully illustrated contract, and one of the pages has 21 small squares, and that was to fill in the names of the children. So it was only not just Irish Catholics that had large families. But that's the Muslim bit. We got some lovely plates of Jerusalem from the 1850s, very early pictures of the Wailing Wall and of the site of the temple. And they're there. And then there's some ethnographical stuff from South America that was sent over, something from Brazil in the old reductions. We had reductions in Paraguay, the sort of centres that the Jesuits ran, educational and utopian type places. And a bell from there. We've got some Plains Indian moccasins, whole variety of things.
And this exhibition is free, isn't it? Open until the end of September?
Yes, open until the 27th of September. It's free, and we've been sponsored by a whole variety of people. So that's how we've been managed to keep it free. And one trust has given us money so that we can sponsor school groups to come. And we can give them a subsidy for their travelling expenses, which is great.
You describe St. Francis Xavier as being in a very socially deprived area. Tell us a little bit about the parish today. It was once the largest Catholic parish in England, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed, yes, with 13,000 Catholics. Yes, it's a massive building. I mean, it's a Grade 2 star listed building. They started building it in 1843, and by the time it opened in 1848, there'd been the Great Hunger, the potato famine in Ireland, and it was too small, although it was built to hold 1,000 people. And they were going to put a fourth aisle into the church. Instead, they built a beautiful chapel at the side, which is the size of a small parish church. So it is a massive building. But as mentioned, it's in the second most deprived area in the country. The indices of deprivation are quite high.
So the sort of problems you're talking about are unemployment, crime, street crime, things like this?
Not so much street crime. Drugs are the biggest problem in the area, and we have quite a big problem. Liverpool being a port, it has problems of drug distribution. So it's one of the places that stuff is sent around the country. And some of our parishioners are in prison because of that. But that's the main thing. No big problems with break-ins and so on, so I'm not worried about the artefacts being stolen. But the deprivation and the level of education is pretty low.
So the church plays quite an important role, I imagine, in trying to, in some way, provide some kind of support for people on the fringes.
Oh, indeed. And we across the road from us, there's a homeless project which we're heavily involved in. We have a pensioners club. And this exhibition has given the parishioners a great deal of encouragement and pride. We've got about 50 helpers who are serving teas, welcoming people at the door and so on. And they're really proud that this exhibition is in their midst. So there's signs of hope all over the place.
And my thanks there to Jesuit brother Ken Vance, administrator at the Church of St. Francis Xavier. And a reminder that Held in Trust exhibition is open daily until September the 27th at St. Francis Xavier's in Liverpool's Everton district. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.